Welcome to the Reach Out podcast, the show where we explore how researchers at Aalborg University and elsewhere use digital technologies to disseminate their knowledge, as well as connect with different audiences. This podcast is supported by generous funding from the Digitalization Strategy at Aalborg University Denmark and produced at Aalborg University Business School. If you want to connect, follow us on Twitter at reachout, that's reachout with A-A-U-T in the end. And now let's jump straight into the interview.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Reach Out podcast. My name is Daniel Hein, and my guest today is Rasmus Hoffmann-Birk. Rasmus, good to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you very much, Daniel. Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Rasmus, before we go deeper into the topic and talk about research dissemination, everything this podcast is about, why don't we get started with you introducing yourself a bit. So what you're doing here at AAU in a large research community, quickly, what your research is about and your past, how you came, where you are at the moment.
Yeah, that's a lot of big questions. How I came where I am at the moment. I biked to work today. That's how I came into the office. No, that's a bad joke. I'm sorry. Edit that out in post. I'm an assistant professor in psychology at the Department of Communication and Psychology here at Aalborg University. Before that, I was a PhD student in the Department of Sociology and Social Work, also here at Aalborg University. And in a sort of interim, I have been a postdoctoral research fellow at King's College London, very generously sponsored by an international postdoc grant from the from Denmark's independent research fund, Denmark's Frie Forskningsfond. And so my research, I'm a psychologist of background, and my research for my PhD, it was on marginalized urban areas in Denmark and the types of social work that go on in those areas. So those areas that they're known so colloquially as the areas on the ghetto list. And since then, my research has sort of changed a little bit more towards the psychological side. So I do research on urban life, so life in cities, and especially I'm especially interested in the relationship between urban life and mental health. So how are we affected by living in cities? How is our mental health affected by living in cities, and so on? So that's sort of broadly what I work on topic wise. And then I use predominantly qualitative approaches towards this. That's basically me in a nutshell, I think.
Okay, all right. That gives us a bit of a glimpse what everything you're communicating and how you spend your time is about. And I mean, obviously, since this is an interdisciplinary podcast, we have people from many different disciplines, and it broadly varies. So for some, they clearly say, okay, I do basic research on some mathematical foundation or foundation of physics or nanoscience or whatnot. The general public has little or no interest in what I'm doing. And that's completely fine because it's very basic, very abstract.
Yeah.
So I could imagine what you're doing links up to a couple of interesting discussions nowadays in society. What people are interested in, what you like to talk about, what are topics which you also hear being discussed in the news. So ghettos, also here in Denmark, impoverished areas, but also more recently, the effect of urbanization on us. Is it good? Is it bad? What does it do to our psyche and so on? So I would imagine there are kind of a lot of things where you have opportunities to link to some public discussion, which always sounds easy in theory. In practice, as a researcher, it's often not. So do you make attempts to do so, to increase your public visibility outside of our traditional, we write paper and publish it in a journal workflow?
That's a very good question. I think I do a little bit, but probably not as much as I should, which comes down to, I mean, the listeners probably will know this. I'm an early career researcher, so I'm an assistant professor, right? I finished my PhD only 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago. So I'm still quite in the sort of larger research community. I'm quite early career. My work on urban life and mental health is also quite early stages, basically. So I think I've done a little bit of public outreach, when journalists have contacted me like once or twice and asked about urban life and mental health. And I've tried to answer in a sort of in a way that is that captures the nuances and what I know, but without oversimplifying it. But I probably haven't done as much sort of direct public outreach as I should. I've done a few workshops when I was in London. I did a few like events and participated in more workshop kind of creative events that were arranged by the university there. So my experience with like public outreach, other than sort of social networks and stuff, is probably limited, if that makes sense. And it is something I should develop. But I think it's actually one of the things that is difficult to do when you're an early career researcher who is still sort of, when you're still developing your topic, if that makes sense, trying to figure out who is your audience, what are your points, what do you know, like what are you certain about when you communicate to the public. That is sort of one of the things I'm always thinking about and working through. I think especially, so obviously my current topic is urban life and mental health, which is not so politicized, but in Denmark, you know, the everything about marginalized urban areas and quote unquote ghettos and stuff is super politicized, and it is not the most pleasant terrain to enter as an early career researcher. And also because my particular take on those topics was very much focused on the social work that goes on in those areas, the work I've done has maybe not catered so much to the particular angles being debated in the sort of the media, basically. That's a very long answer, sorry.
But that's fine. So let's unfold that all a bit. So, yeah. I mean, your stance on that is obviously quite typical for many researchers. Most of us have the feeling, yeah, probably what I'm doing could be interesting to a larger audience and would probably be beneficial to reach it. How to go about that is not always clear. So that was one of the motivations behind this podcast and like the larger reach out projects. Also, academia is a very peculiar institution because after 4 or 5 years on a topic, we still consider ourselves as juniors, early career researchers, yeah, everywhere in consulting. Any topic you would talk about, you would walk on for 3 years, you would be a senior expert. So be a bit more humble and a bit more critical. And what I often heard from other researchers on this podcast and elsewhere is that it's a critical skill to assess if journalists, for example, reach out to you, what questions should you answer and which questions should you not answer? So where do you feel yourself competent and where you might get yourself a bit into issues? So do you have experience like that as well? I heard a bit out of that.
Yeah, you mean in terms of like how to handle when journalists contact you, basically?
Yes.
Yeah, a little bit. Like I haven't had that many people journalists contact me, but I had a few times. And I had one time where someone contacted me specifically about, you know, urban mental health, which was sort of one of my newer topics. But I probably, you're right, you know, I'm an early career researcher, but I probably do know more about that than the general public. So I answered those questions quite thoroughly, and I asked actually specifically because it's a little bit of a complex topic and there's loads of limits to what we can say. I think it was about, basically, there are studies that show that if you live in a city, then you have a higher risk of developing some mental disorders, maybe. But there are loads of caveats to that research, like there is with many things, right? Because that is a very difficult thing to study and to sort of find out and have concrete knowledge about.
Yes, and I would also imagine that journalists are not necessarily interested in the whole disclaimer. They would like to have, okay, is it like that? Yeah. So are we all getting sick living in cities or not?
Pretty much. And the answer to that is, yes, maybe it depends, you know, like it depends. And there are so many caveats. And where were the studies done? And some of the studies were done in Denmark and in Northern Europe, but you can discuss the methods more. And then there were studies done from like Southern Europe that don't show the same thing. So what is happening? Like, are our studies flawed? Is there something different going on? So in that concrete instance, I asked for the quotation, basically, to see it, to preview it. And I don't think necessarily all journalists would do that, depending on the deadline. I don't know. And then I made some edits to it, like requested some changes that were accommodated quite nicely. And then I had another time where I was asked, and this was in the beginning of the pandemic, and this is one of the things you get when you work in a psychology department, and you get people wanting to know about psychology. And I got like an email about I think discrimination and the pandemic and Danish tourists abroad. And to be honest, I answered the journalists that they should ask someone else in my department. I recommended them someone because it was sort of a bit outside my area of expertise. I didn't feel like comfortable answering it. At least not without having done any reading. I probably could have given some sort of answer, but I also thought when you're asked as an expert in a way, when you're asked to give your expert quote unquote opinion, I think you sort of have a big responsibility in a way to sort of have to give a good answer. That's also why, you know, I would ask for quotations and to double check things because you can't just be saying anything, you know?
Yes, and I think that's a relatively good advice to make ourselves also a bit more confident, because I know not from own experience, but from a lot of experience of fellows that you're at an interview and you say something and it's kind of misreflected, not on purpose, but just to make it more catchy, but thereby becoming a bit misleading. This might be because there was short time, it was explained simply, or the journalist didn't fully understand it or wanted to hear a particular thing.
Yeah.
So having a bit of a review of that is probably good advice. Maybe one more thing. So when you're talking about that, you in the beginning of the corona crisis and at other points being contacted by journalists, I, from also my experience talking with researchers, many actually would like to be contacted by journalists. Some in the corona times, which had a particularly catchy issue, said actually, oh, it was way too much, I could do nothing else. But most actually would like to be a bit contacted and have a platform to communicate what they're doing to the general public. So how did they find you? Was it only about, was it independent search of who is doing a PhD on a topic that could match, or so what were the channels that led them to you?
I think so I've been contacted a few times by journalists. I must say it's not something that happens that regular to me, and I think the first time was about urban mental health, and I think that was because when I got my postdoctoral research grant, there was like a small press release and I wrote a little bit about my project, which was about urban mental health, and then there was a report out about mental health in Copenhagen, I think. And I think it was the journalist was probably Googling. So that was the first time. And the second time, I think that was literally just a case of who we want someone to speak about psychological aspects of this topic. Let's start with the psychology departments in Denmark and then go through their websites and contact people who seem to know things about social psychology, which is more or less also my field. So I think that's where that came from. I think that was just a sort of random search.
Okay, all right. So let's move on a bit, because we, as researchers nowadays, or I don't know, it was probably always like that, feel that in an optimal case, we would communicate to a variety of stakeholders, including policymakers, business, larger society, but also other researchers. And there's only so much time, so we have to focus our effort a bit. And obviously, the broader public is great, but there are also other stakeholders. And some of the important stakeholders are obviously our peers and fellows also. And create not necessarily only public, but academic visibility is also an important aspect of the job, obviously. We always like to believe we just write our papers and publish it somewhere and the rest will come on its own. But many of us figure out along the way that's not really the case. So we need other ways of, within our research community, also gain and keep our visibility. So how do you go about that?
Yeah,
your tools.
Oh, that's a very good question. I think it's very difficult, actually. Like, we have a very overloaded attention economy today, right? Like, you have so many papers coming out, there are so many journals. It's difficult to sort through the good journals. It's difficult to sort as a researcher. You get bombarded with like requests to publish in various predatory journals as well. So there's just such a massive information overload at this stage that I actually think I don't want to sound like, oh, I have a very good strategy for this to get out, because I don't necessarily think I do. You know, like I know a lot of, I think for me it is, how to figure it out. I think I go about, like, I have a social media profile. I have a Twitter account that I sort of use for networking more than dissemination, if that makes sense. Like, I pontificate a little bit about various musings sometimes. I reply to other people. I actually rarely send out tweets about my own research unless I get something published. But I use that more to communicate with my peers, other researchers, to find out who's doing what, to sort of help me sift through the sort of overloaded attention economy of academia and the world, to be honest, at the moment, and to try and figure out, okay, what is happening where, who seems like cool people, how can I, and sort of, and sometimes, you know, if someone is, you get sort of people asking about like literature sometimes, and if I've written something about one topic, I can sort of sometimes, not that often, send them one or two of my papers. But yeah, I sort of use Twitter and then various informal, I think it's mainly informal networking I do, to be honest. I think, yeah, that's probably my way of going about that. And I built my own personal website, which I haven't updated for a while. But yeah, those are sort of my two main channels, social networking and sort of my website, I think.
Okay, so let's go then to the website for a moment. You say like kind of you didn't update it for a while. And I mean, it's also not that easy to develop like kind of good and robust routines, because then there's a lot of other stuff to do. Mm-hmm. But at least like, you took the first step there. So what made you create your own website, and how did you do it infrastructure-wise?
So I was on Twitter, which is what I do, and I saw there's a researcher at Oslo University, I think, called Dan Quintana, who has a big following on Twitter and publishes a lot of like very accessible guides for academics. If you are interested in this kind of stuff, I can really recommend checking out his stuff. And he had a guide for how to use the coding program R to how to make your own website. And he had a very sort of accessible guide that was like, this seems like an easy task for me to do today, where I don't have that so much on the schedule. And it ended up taking me way too long, and much longer than he said. But it was a sort of a nice task to try and learn some coding tools. And so that's how I went about it, basically. His guide, installing R, and then going through that. And then I built a very standard website that sort of has a small introduction for myself, my CV, instead of a list of publications, I have like a link to my Google Scholar profile, which I sort of find is a very nice tool for dissemination as well, and for sort of keeping a very handy, accessible, and sort of easily overview a website that gives you a nice and easy overview. So I sort of went about it through that, basically. I followed his guide. I used R and upload. I think some of the stuff was uploaded to GitHub already, which I could sort of source it from. And that's sort of the very banal story of how I built that academic website. It was a little bit more time consuming than I thought it would be. Maybe that speaks to my technical skills or lack thereof.
I mean, the first step, for sure, when you're coming in a new infrastructure, is most of the time the hardest. So that's also quite normal. But is it a static website, or do you also use it? Because often we hear, okay, now that I also already have this website, I can figure it out, I can also use it as a blog. Because on Twitter, there's only so much like deep insights I can communicate.
Yeah, I have thought about using it. I don't use it at the moment. I have thought about it. So at the moment, it is mainly sort of a super short presentation of myself, kind of CV, like that I have thought I would like to expand on more, maybe use as a blog. I think one of the challenges is actually, like, you can use that as your own blog and do that stuff, but there are just so many blogging tools now. A lot of people and even researchers have moved to stuff like Substack, more like newslettering kind of stuff. That the question of building your own website is really, I mean, you can do it and it is time consuming, but I think that might actually, and it can be useful. You have more of a hand in it, more control, I think, but there are so many other, maybe more easily, easily disseminated, like other platforms that can save you some time.
Okay, yeah, that's definitely true. But I like to believe there's also value maintaining your own websites. And I guess we probably put up the link you mentioned before in the show notes. But coming back to the website, so what did you think, even though you said like, hey, it's not full blown up to now, but having this website, how do you feel? Was that just an exercise for you, or do you feel actually you gained something from it? Do you lead people to that, and is that helpful for other people to summarize your work, or how do you use it, or what kind of how did you feel that it is there versus it is not there?
It was slightly an exercise for myself. I think it was a way of trying to sort of take the first steps into building, like moving a little bit away from being an unknown early career researcher into sort of trying to build a little bit more of a name for myself, if that makes sense. So it was an exercise a little bit in doing more public outreach, having it uploaded, and then trying to think of, okay, what should I actually do about it? I think maybe it was also, I mean, my mistake was probably taking it as a technical challenge and then not really thinking about, okay, what am I actually going to put on this website? Who is it for? Is it going to just be a way of communicating to me? Which is sort of what I've been using it for so far, right? Like people can contact me through it and can find my name. And I've had a few times where I've met people briefly at conferences and maybe they haven't gotten my name and they can Google me and then that website pops up, right? There's also, obviously my name is Rasmus Birk or Rasmus Berg, and depending on if you pronounce it in Danish or English. And there's another guy in Aalborg actually with the same name who also has a public profile. So I think I also built this website to be like, okay, I need to differentiate myself a little bit. He's not a researcher, but he's a music teacher and stuff. And he comes up when you search my name or our name. And I figured I need to differentiate myself a little bit. I need to build more of a profile for myself. And I also wanted to, like for recruitment for research projects and stuff, it can be useful to sort of have some sort of, not necessarily for recruitment, because that also has to go through official channels in the university more officially, but it can be useful for like disseminating your results and findings and everything for people who have maybe participated in a research project. So that is sort of a long-term goal, I think. But of course, that also depends on you having stuff to disseminate, and sort of research in many instances, it's a very slow moving process, unfortunately. And fortunately, that is one of the weaknesses and advantages, I think, of it.
Yeah, and that's what I often also heard, that once you set up so that your own website is just where it gets started. So often it's not necessarily about, okay, it's nice to have this website. Okay, here, that is me. There's a link to my Google Scholar. That's what I generally do. This is my picture. But then you figure out, okay, it's actually rather easy and fast to do once you know the workflow. Why don't use it also for projects? So often when we have our Horizon 2020 or whatever project, we get some media agency on board and throw some €10,000 on them. And we also ask them, okay, is that really necessary, at least in the first step, to get something fast out? And many then use this kind of form. So is your website, how did you host it?
I think I just hosted it personally via, I've forgotten. I should have looked this up. It's called Webify or something like that, which was a very easy hosting.
Yes.
Yeah, which was a very easy platform, basically. And then I bought the domain name. So that was sort of just personal hosting fees. And I think it's free, actually, or very cheap, at least.
Yeah, exactly. It is. We probably ought to put a link up. I mean, nowadays, it's even easier without going this additional step. You can just do it via GitHub pages so that it remains on GitHub. So, yeah, I guess we are already reaching the end slowly. So time always flies in podcasts. So we talked a bit about how to handle and how to deal with journalists and like kind of a public interest. What are the first steps to create a first way to your own website? What are toolings for it, and what else could it potentially be used for? So anything else you want to give others on the way, which are wondering about, like kind of how can I make either myself as a researcher or my research more visible to whatever kind of audience? So what are things you learn? If there's anything, the main things you learned on the way.
Yeah, okay. So I think the main thing I've learned is, at least in terms of building a website or building a Twitter following or whatever, I don't have a very big Twitter following, is I think to have some sort of plan for it. I think that maybe was my mistake, but one of the things I didn't do so much with my website was it was more of a technical challenge. I want to build this, but I didn't really so much have like a multi-step plan or a long-term strategy. That's just still time, and I should probably go home and do that now after this podcast. So that's one thing, trying to think about what is actually the point of this. And then I think for sort of social networking and Twitter and all that kind of stuff, I think you know, the best people on those platforms are the ones who don't necessarily have a, I mean, on the one hand, I'm going to say build a strategy, but also don't seem up, like, don't have that be your main thing. As a, okay, I'm going to post my research here on like a link and then two words, and then I'm logging off Twitter for the day. It is the point of it and the fun of it is to try and engage with people. And I think that is something that should maybe, that you can think about. Think about engagement in those strategies, I guess. That would be my sort of very basic advice.
And that's a very good point, and I think a perfect ending for this podcast. So, Rasmus, thank you so much, and good luck with all the future ventures. And next month, I'm taking another look at your website, see how it how it has grown in content.
Thank you. That's a good deadline to have. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.